Welcome, everyone. You guys are in for a treat. If you want to hear from a seasoned real estate pro, then wait until you hear what Raj has to say. We have Raj Gupta on the show today, and Raj is going to talk to us about what he looks for in partners. He's also going to talk about how he scaled his real estate business, and he's going to get into his views on where we are in the economic cycle.
Welcome to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show. Each week, you will learn how to grow your wealth through real estate investing. Be introduced to the players that are getting it done and learn how you can get involved. And now, here's your host, Darren Batchelder.
Welcome, everyone. I am Darren Batchelder, and I will be your host. Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show is a free weekly show that will be released every Tuesday morning. So what do I believe in? I believe in God. I believe in family and friends. I believe in the American way. I believe in the entrepreneurial spirit. I believe in relationships. I believe in hope. I believe in learning. I believe in hard work. I believe in the ability to create wealth no matter where you get started. I believe in taking action and going after your dreams. I believe we are stronger together. So what motivates me? What drives me? What's my why? One, I'm looking for financial freedom like many of you, and I believe that working together is the way to go. Secondly, I want to inspire others to go after their dreams. This show is focused on real estate. Having said that, I want to inspire others no matter what their dream is. Now, a little background on myself. I've been in the loan trading business for over 18 years and have traded over $4 billion in residential, multifamily, and commercial real estate loans. At the end of 2017, I decided to finally take action and get into the real estate business, and specifically the multifamily syndication business. To date, I've invested in 9 multifamily deals with over 4,000 units. 7 of those deals I've invested passively with other lead sponsors. 1 deal I took the lead and acted as the lead sponsor. And 1 deal I partnered with 2 other well-established general partners for a small minority stake in the deal. I started this podcast to get the word out and to let more people know that they can get involved in real estate investing. This is a way for me to give back and to serve others. I've had so many people help me along the way, and I look forward to engaging with all of you. There is still so much to learn, and I look forward to learning from the guests on this show and from all of you listeners. My role is to bring people on the show that will share their wisdom and experience to help you grow your wealth. Your role is to take action, one step at a time. Please take the time to listen, and please let me know your feedback. We will learn and grow together. A little background on Raj Gupta before we start the show. Raj practiced law as a Navy officer. Then he was an advisor to super high net worth individuals, and then transitioned into large-scale real estate. His most recent deal was a $42 million multifamily community. Now, on to the show. Hey, Raj, welcome to the show. I am so excited to have you on the show. This is our first episode, and I am so honored to have you.
Hey, Darren, how's it going? I'm so happy to be here and so honored that you invited me to be your first guest on your new podcast. And I think you're going to do great things with this podcast. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how it grows and what you end up doing with it.
Fantastic. Listeners, you guys are in for a treat because Raj is a rock star. And first, before we get started, Raj, I want to say thank you for your service. You were an officer in the Navy, and there are so many people across this great country that are thankful for those that step up and make the decision to serve. And you were one of them, and just want to say thank you.
I appreciate that, Darren. Thank you.
Absolutely. So where Raj and I met, we're both members of a local, well, local for me. I live in the North Dallas area, and there's a multifamily mentorship group. Brad Sumrock runs it in Dallas. And Raj and I met while being at a number of the marketing events within that group. And Raj is located in Chicago, in Naperville. So first thing I wanted to do, Raj, was I've already introduced you to listeners before we got on, but you're a rock star investor. You've been investing since 2008, you know, over 4,000 units. You've done single family, you've done multifamily, you've done large scale multifamily, you've bought, you've sold, you've rehabbed. And then you went and joined this multifamily mentorship group after you've done all that. So my big question to you is, you know, after having all that experience, what value did you see in joining a group like this?
Well, that's a good question. I have to be honest, like when I first went to that group, this is back in March of 2018, it was purely out of curiosity. Most of my properties, as you know, is in the Dallas area. And I had actually just sold my first multifamily property. It's 128 units in Duncanville, which is outside of Dallas, just about 2 weeks prior to that. And the sponsors that I sold it to, the buyers, were actually a part of this Sumrock group. I had actually received several offers from different sponsors within that group. And so I talked to the broker, Taylor Snowdy, who had the listing. I said, hey, tell me about this Sumrock group. I keep hearing about them. And we got several offers from them, you know, and he said, well, check out their website. You should check them out. They're a great group and they're in Dallas local, and check out their website and go to their event. And so I did. And there was a rat race to retirement event, which is what Sumrock calls it. And it was literally coming up in like 2 weeks. And so I signed up purely out of curiosity. And when I went there was like 700 people there, like-minded, you know, right. great people, right? I mean, just, I was so impressed by just the enthusiasm and their backgrounds. And I met a lot of people that weekend. And I honestly had no intention of like signing up or joining the group. You know, I've been doing this a long time, didn't feel like I needed mentorship or anything like that. But I ended up on an impulse sort of writing the check and joining. And the reason is because of the power of surrounding yourself with like-minded people. Right. And it's fun, first of all. And, you know, you and I met there.
Absolutely. You
know, and we ended up doing a deal together. And I have another partner, Anna Simpson, who I also met in that group. And it's been such a phenomenal experience. And it's really allowed me to scale what I was doing as well. So my growth in this industry really is exponentially larger and faster than it would have been if I hadn't joined. And, you know, when I learned the business, I didn't have the luxury of a mentor or being part of a mentorship group. And so, you know, primarily I was self-taught, and that, you know, that has its advantages, but it has its disadvantages too, because I think there's so much power and synergy from networking and meeting like-minded people and partnering and teaming up and sharing ideas, that I think if I could do it over again, I would have joined a group like that years earlier.
That's great. Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited that you joined, because that's where we met, and we actually did business together and did a deal together. But, you know, I have a lot of people that reach out to me on Instagram and they're looking to get started. And that's one of the biggest first steps in my mind, is surround yourself with other like-minded people. And here you are, you know, you are already a success story. You didn't necessarily need it, but, you know, by joining the group, what you've said is, one, you ended up partnering with two different people, myself and Anna Simpson. You did one deal with me, and you've done, I think, three deals with Anna, right?
It's five
properties. Five deals? Holy cow. Mm-hmm. So six deals through two partners, and total units of that was probably what?
Total is close to 1,000.
Close to 1,000 units, you know, yeah, since joining the group. So that's fantastic. And that's something I think is so critical for anybody that wants to get into this space, is to surround yourself with like-minded people, because there are other people that aren't in the space, you know, may tell you that it's too difficult, you know, that you know, but when you're surrounded with like-minded people that have done 2, 3, 4, 5 deals, they're rooting you on. And they tell you how you can do it instead of how you, you know, how, what all the challenges getting started. So that's fantastic. So you partnered with two people that you met with the group, myself and Anna. Help our listeners understand, you know, why would somebody that already has experience want to partner with somebody? So for me, it was my first sponsorship deal, and you decided to partner with me. And with Anna, she was a very experienced sponsor that already had a number of deals under her belt. So two different partners that you've partnered with, you know, why did you decide to partner with each of us? And, you know, what was the value that the other side brought to the table?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, whether it's real estate or business or anything else, when you're deciding to potentially partner up with somebody, you know, first of all, you got to like them. I think that's really important. You have to, you know, have a hopefully see things in a similar way, have a similar work ethic and a similar vision. But I think, you know, for me, this business is almost impossible to scale if you're going to be on your own. I mean, there is so much as a syndicator, as a multifamily syndicator, there's just so much to it, from underwriting deals daily to, you know, managing the assets once you've already acquired them, raising capital, dealing with brokers and insurance and tax protests. And I mean, I could just go on and on and on, and you're aware of this, but there are so many different aspects to it. And if you have one property, maybe you can do it. If you have multiple, or if you have the ambition to grow your portfolio, it's basically impossible unless you bring on partners. And it should be people that you trust. For me, it was people that I trust, people that I liked, people that brought something to the table. And that's the other thing. Like, if you're going to partner, yeah, you know, every partner has to bring something to the table.
Right.
And whether it's, you know, experience or know-how or a balance sheet to help get approved for loans, or, you know, just asset management, having the time to spend to deal with the property management companies. And then also, you know, it helps if there's a network of potential investors as well when you are trying to raise capital for a deal. And so all of those are different considerations, and different people have different strengths. And you also want to take a look at, you know, where your strengths lie, and maybe if there's some gaps there, you want to see if you can find that in a partner as well. So, but I'd say, if I'm honest, a lot of it's gut feeling.
Right.
And just if I get a good sense about it, you know, I don't think there's a formula to it. You were one of the first people that I met in the group. And, you know, you asked me, hey, this is before you had done a deal. Hey, if I find one, would you be interested in potentially partnering with me? And I told you yes, you know, and then you did. You followed up. And so that's great. And here we are. We're good friends. And, you know, we've done a deal together and it's going really well. So
absolutely.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of power in partnerships.
I think that's great perspective for our listeners. And, you know, so, you know, two different partners. Myself, I was a, you know, first time guy. Again, I talked to a number of people that reach out to me, and some of them, it's a mindset thing. Some people think to themselves, I'm a first time investor. What do I have to offer somebody that's senior, that has already done? And what I found from being part of the group, and I think what helped it work for me and you, was I asked around to the senior syndicators that already had a number of deals under their belt. And they're like, look, I can't look at every deal, right? I'm looking at, you know, 200 plus unit deals, and, you know, you're probably looking at smaller deals. So that's what I chose to focus on, 60 to 100 units. I found a 76 unit deal, and then you weren't even looking at that deal. So if I did some of the groundwork and laid the groundwork and then partnered with you, but I bring it up because there's a lot of people that think to themselves, they almost talk themselves out of the fact that they can provide value to a senior guy. And I'm here to tell you that that's not the case, to the listeners, that there is value to the hustler. to the person that is going to go out and find the deal that the senior guys are not focused on. So, you know, build relationships and then focus on deals that they're not looking at. And then that's how you add value to them. All right, I'm going to take a little bit of a turn here. So, and I don't even know the answers. We've spent quite a bit of time together, and I don't even know all the answers to this. Let's go back to your childhood. So where did you grow up? Did you grow up rich, poor, middle class? What was kind of your upbringing?
Yeah, so I was born in Evanston, Illinois, back in 1970. And a lot of people know Evanston because that's where Northwestern University is located. It's a suburb of Chicago. For the first 7 years of my life, I grew up in Rogers Park, which is on the north side of the city. And then in 1978, my family moved out to Naperville, and I've been in Naperville ever since. So Naperville's been home for, you know, what is that, 42 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I was young, and I have two older brothers, and I'm the baby in the family. I think growing up, we're middle class. My parents were immigrants from India, and it's that age-old immigrant story. You know, you come to the United States for the opportunity, and you work hard, and you save, and you know, you try to do what's right for the family, and that's what happened with my parents. My dad was the first one in the his family to come and to the United States, and same with my mom. So it's just one of those stories. So we kind of grew up with that that mentality, just you know, work hard, and we didn't have a lot of luxuries growing up. Pretty humble,
right.
I'd say, upbringing, and kind of went from there.
Have you read the book by Sam Zell? I forget the name of the book, but he came out with a book recently. His parents also immigrants and grew up with that in that mentality, and has stayed, and he's a billionaire, and he's, you know, still, you know, has a lot of values that were instilled by his parents. And so that's strong. Let me ask you this, because I think that mindset, again, is so important. Was there a time when you were a child at some point where you said to yourself, I'm going to be successful? And if so, what did that look like? Where were you? What did that look like? And what did success kind of paint that picture for us?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think depending on what phase or stage in my life I was, I'd answer that differently. Probably in high school at some point, I had an intuition that I wanted to live an exceptional life, right? And I don't know at that time, at that young age, what exactly that meant. I think by the time I got to college, for me, success had nothing to do with monetary success. I just wasn't wired that way at that time.
Yeah,
it was more like life experiences. I wanted to be the most well-rounded guy out of everyone, right? Out of my social circle. I wanted to be able to talk intelligently about any number of things, whether it's religion or history or art or sports or, you know, anything. And I just wanted to be that guy that had, you know, different interests and different hobbies and could speak intelligently about different things and be well-rounded. And the people that I knew that were like that are the people that I respected the most. So like when I was, you know, and traveling, right, back then, and we didn't have a lot of money back then, you know, I would find ways to travel on the cheap, you know, and with my buddies. And those are the things that I really admired. And it wasn't, I didn't really admire people just for being wealthy.
Right.
That didn't, or being successful in their businesses at that age. Now, I mean, now I do at this stage in my life, right? I do respect because I know how hard it is to be successful as an entrepreneur and things. And I respect that. But I would say the way I'm wired and the way I grew up, you know, for years, I really focused on more on being well-rounded and having a lot of different interests. And also, you know, not it all being about making money, you know. And, you know, I'm sure you're going to ask me about the Navy later, but just
right.
I think service is really important, not just military service, but just thinking outside of yourself, you know, And there's so much that life has to offer, and it's so rich, and there's so much to experience. And I think I was really motivated by that. And that led to me trying to travel as much as I can and read as much as I can and meet as many different people from different walks of life and learn from them.
That's a fantastic perspective. And, you know, you hear all the time financial freedom or, you know, freedom. And, you know, I'm searching for financial freedom. And part of that is the finances, that you could do whatever you want to do, right? And you're not beholden to a job. But part of that is the freedom of your time also. And it sounded like, you know, your first experience or first vision of success was kind of, you know, freedom to do what you wanted to do. I believe that if somebody wants to get involved in real estate, they have to at some point like see themselves doing it. It doesn't have to be just real estate. It could be starting a business, whatever it is, but you have to see yourself there, and you have to actually make the decision that you're going to do what it takes to get there. If you don't do that, I would give anybody the advice, just keep doing what you're doing, because you, in order to achieve something different, you're going to have to make a conscious decision that you're going to sacrifice to get there, sacrifice something. All right, let's move on to your service in the Navy. You know, why did you decide to, one, go into the armed forces, and then why'd you pick the Navy?
So, because it's the best, obviously.
it's good to hear you say that for, you know, all those Navy guys out there. I'm sure that they're loving to hear that.
So when I was in college at the University of Illinois in Chicago, one of my closest friends, Neil Willman, had been in the Navy for, at that time, maybe I think 7 years, and he had gotten selected to this officer program, which included the Navy sending him to school and so to college. So I met him there, and, you know, he was just chock full of all kinds of Navy stories, you know, about traveling the world. I had this interest going back to even before I met Neil, and I had joined the Army ROTC my freshman year of college, which I don't think you're aware of.
No, I wasn't aware of that.
And I was just always intrigued by military service. And I always just thought it was such a noble thing to do, and to serve your country, and again, to just be part of something larger than yourself. And then I had switched schools after my freshman year, and then I met Neil, and he told me all these stories about the Navy and just about all his travels. And just kind of going back to what I was saying before, I mean, at that stage in my life, I was just all about life experience and challenging myself and seeing the world and things like that, right? And in addition to, you know, I wasn't really motivated by money at that time. And so it's, you know, to me, I was just really interested in the Navy. One way or another, I didn't know what I wanted to do for a living yet. But one way or another, I was going to find a way if I could join the Navy. And eventually, I ended up deciding I wanted to go to law school and be a lawyer. And literally within a week of starting law school, I met with the Navy recruiter. And I said, hey, I want to apply for the Navy JAG Corps. And I applied, and I got accepted by the end of that first year of law school.
That's fantastic. Once again, thank you for your service. There's, you know, there's not that many people that step up and have that service attitude. So that's fantastic. Now, you spent how many years in the Navy?
So I did active duty for about 4 years. Most of that was spent in Naples, Italy.
Okay.
So I was there from 2001 to 2004, which was a pretty incredible time period to be there.
From what perspective?
Us, for that matter. Well, I mean, I went there, I got to Naples in February of 2001, and September of 2001, 9/11 happened.
Right.
And to be, you know, in an overseas base at that time was just such an intense and surreal experience. And, you know, and then we started the Afghanistan war later that year. And then in 2003, we started the Iraq war, or, you know, the war started. So that 4 year period was really, really intense. And it was a very special time. I mean, for me,
special in what way?
Well, I think it's one of the times in my life where, you know, I was just really proud and grateful for what I was doing and what I was part of. It was, it's all about service. So when you're in the military, and especially when, you know, your country's been attacked like that and we're fighting these wars, and to be abroad during that time, it was just a very moving experience. And it's just one of those things that, you know, I could hold up my head up high and just be proud that I was serving. And also, I mean, taking it back to my earlier comment, the life experience was incredible. Serving, being involved in that environment, but just living overseas for 4 years and having, you know, developing just extremely close relationships with the Italians, who I, you know, I'm close to this day. And they were very, you know, they were very supportive. And I remember clearly when 9/11 happened and we were watching it live, and they were feeling it as intensely and as strongly as we were, as the Americans were. So it was a very moving experience. It was before I had kids. So, you know, it was a special time in our nation's history, but also just for me personally.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing that. Definitely gives us a different perspective. I was getting goosebumps thinking about you being overseas at that time. You know, the armed forces also is very disciplined, right? It's a very disciplined approach. And what kind of character attributes did you walk away with that you still hold near and dear to your heart as you, you know, run your business today?
That's a good question. I think it's had a big impact on my life and my values. So first of all, I think, again, service, I've mentioned it before, but
you're still involved, right?
I'm still in the reserves. Right. Yeah. So I've, I'm actually going to hit 20 years in July.
Fantastic.
Combination of active and active duty and reserve time. But I think it's very easy in our profession to just be entirely focused on growth and on money and, you know, things like that, accumulating wealth. And those are, I'm not trying to minimize that. It's all really important. But I think, you know, when you're in the military, that's, you know, that's not really what it's about. And it's really about serving something, a greater mission, you know, beyond your own personal growth or financial growth. And then, you know, I think the experience of living overseas was really something else. But also, you know, what I did in the Navy was I was a JAG, Judge Advocate General, so an attorney for the Navy. And during that four-year period, I probably had 1,000 different clients. And including, you know, for probably about 2 years of that, I litigated in the courtroom. And I think that experience, it really, you know, I kind of developed the abilities to work with clients and to understand what it means to be a zealous advocate for somebody else and looking out for them. And then I also learned how to communicate, I think, better being in the courtroom. And, you know, you have to persuade. And
you are a smooth talker.
So, but it's really, you know, they don't call it sales, but it is, right? You're persuading people, you're persuading juries, you're persuading judges. You have to come up with a theory, what they call a theory of the case, a strategy, what's going to be in your client's best interest. You know, you have to have a strategy and then kind of execute on it. I see a lot of similarities between that and what I do in real estate. Dealing with investors is not that much different than dealing with clients,
right?
As a lawyer, and you know, you're looking out for their best interest, but also, you know, what's the best strategy to implement, and then you have to execute on that strategy, and then you have to. A lot of that has to do with good partners and knowing who to delegate to and who to rely on, and doing research, and then also just communication skills. I think that experience in the Navy has had a lasting impact on me professionally.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing. And I share a parallel thought. I don't have the armed services background, but you know, I have kind of a two-prong approach where, you know, I'm looking to grow my wealth and financial freedom, but I also really charges me up is if I can help somebody else, you know, either get inspired to go after something that they're afraid to go after or they didn't think they could achieve. And that could be in real estate or that could be somewhere, you know, in a different avenue altogether, starting a business or whatever. And I don't care about getting paid for that. Right. So like it just is part of life service giving back that it pays you dividends just, you know, to your well-being. And it's part of, you know, my core. And it sounds like, you know, serving your country was and is part of your core. And that's awesome. So thank you for sharing that.
Absolutely.
So now you come back. And then you, at some point, transition from being in the service to being a wealth advisor to high net worth and super high net worth individuals. So, you know, why the change into that industry? And kind of the same question, like what during that time period, what kind of helped build your character and what have you taken from that experience?
Yeah, so my father was an engineer for over 20 years. And then in 1989, he followed his passions, which was investments, and became a financial advisor. And I was just starting college. 1989 is the year that I graduated high school.
Which that's a little surprising because, you know, our generation is doing that, but yeah. You know, our parents' generations typically were afraid to take that risk, right? So that was a big jump for your dad to do after being 20 years engineer. So you saw that.
Huge. Yeah. So, and you know, I'm the youngest, as I mentioned. And so my dad wanted to make that change years earlier, but didn't feel like it was the prudent thing to do to make a career change until my older brothers were, you know, more established in their careers. And as I was, you know, entering college, and I think he felt like at that time, the timing was right. I mean, my dad, growing up, as I mentioned, as an immigrant, I mean, pretty conservative, very hardworking, didn't try to live lavishly, tried to save as much as he can. And it was all, you know, I remember just, he was constantly working and being conservative. And then, but at the time, you know, when it made sense, he took a risk. And I think some of that has definitely shaped who I am. And
that's,
you know,
that's huge.
I feel like I have some of those characteristics that I learned from him. And I also have made a couple of different career changes, as you alluded to. And those were some of the biggest decisions I've ever made in my life. So, and, you know, look, no looking back, I'm very grateful for where I am. And I think the decisions that I've made have worked out well. I'm very happy. Put a lot of thought into them. I don't do things impulsively that much, but, you know, really happy that I've made some of those changes.
That's fantastic. So that being a wealth advisor to high net worth individuals, I would think there's a lot of things that you can bring across to, you know, syndicating large scale multifamily. Would you agree? And if so, what kind of carried forward?
Yeah, for sure. So I think, you know, you were asking me about what sort of attributes I gained from that experience. And I'd say, you know, at least a couple in particular. And one is similar to when I was a lawyer, is just having clients and being a fiduciary and really being a steward of their capital, of their investment capital, and really taking that responsibility seriously. And, you know, and having lived through the 2008 Great Recession and just seeing people's nest egg really taking a hit and things like that. So I think, so having that, taking that responsibility very, very seriously about managing people's assets and their hard-earned money. That's definitely part of it. The second thing is that at least when I was in that field, I just became a student of the economy and economic cycles and the things that impact, you know, interest rates and the stock market and, you know, what the Fed's doing with monetary policy and what's going on with inflation and what are the best investments, you know, to mitigate some of that risk. And I became obsessed with risk, I would say.
Right.
And
we've had many discussions where you are definitely a student of economic cycles and how to manage risk, which is critical in both in being a wealth advisor and also being a steward of investors' money for large scale multifamily. So that's amazing. You know, having said that, you know, we're in the middle of right now, one of the largest crises we'll probably ever live through in our lifetime with COVID-19. You know, help us and the listeners understand, you know, what's your perspective? What, you know, how bad do you think this is going to be? And how long do you think it's going to take to come out of this? And how does that impact real estate? And what parts of real estate do you think are going to hit worse than others? And, you know, I don't want to spend 20 minutes on this, but look, Raj, you are a student of this, and I've spent a lot of time over dinner and having a few beers talking about this stuff. And so I want you to share your perspective because you have a lot of knowledge in this area.
Yeah. So let me, a lot of fertile ground there for discussion. So one of, you know, my clients, when I was in that space were, as you mentioned, high net worth, ultra high net worth families. And, you know, these are people that had already made a lot of money, right? And so my number one job, as I took it, was to preserve their savings and their money. And then secondarily, to try to grow it responsibly. And what that meant was managing risk. And what that means, and there's a lot of different types of risk. And what that meant is really being a student of the economy and making sure, because the economy is always changing. It's a dynamic thing. And so I'm a firm believer that when you're investing, that it has to be dynamic because the economy is always changing and your investment decisions should be informed by where we are in the economic cycle. And so, and that was just drilled into me. As an advisor, and I have definitely taken that approach in real estate as well. So, you know, and I'll talk about the COVID-19 situation in a minute. I think all investments, whether it's multifamily, whether it's stocks, bonds, you know, commodities, options, everything should be looked at from a risk versus reward standpoint. So it's not enough to just, you know, to assess the upside on an investment. You got to look at the downside. You got to look at what's the, you know, probabilities of success or failure and weigh it all out. And as you're doing so, only invest in the investments that are the most attractive and compelling from a risk versus reward standpoint. Mm. And I think that is so fundamental to how I do things. And it's just been drilled into me. And that's how I, when I'm syndicating a deal, I absolutely think of it in that way. And if it is attractive from a risk versus reward standpoint, then I'll move forward and be interested in it. And if it doesn't, my personal decision is to stay away from it. And so it's had a huge impact on how I think about things. Do you want me to transition to the current situation?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That'd be great.
So, you know, obviously unprecedented. Now, I would say if you rewind the clock 3 or 4 months, what was known objectively was that we were in the longest expansion in U.S. history.
Right.
I mean, going back to 2009, you know, so 11 years, literally the longest in our history, very long in the tooth.
And, right. Everybody was saying that, you know, over 2 or 3 years, last 2 or 3 years, we know we're near the end of the cycle. We just don't know when it's coming and what's going to cause it. But here we are.
And so I think it was entirely predictable because everything is cyclical that there was going to be a downturn coming. That's nothing super profound. It was going to happen. We just don't know exactly when it's going to happen, but it certainly informed my investment decisions even before the pandemic. And the reason is because, you know, when the cycle turns downward and we go into a recession, and it's not a question of if, it's a question of when, because of the cyclical nature of it, you want to make sure that whatever you're investing in is going to hold up okay. It's going to be relatively resilient in that kind of an environment. And there are certain investments that are much more sensitive to downturns and vulnerable, and others that are going to be more resilient and hopefully hold up better. And so I think from my perspective, I was trying to focus on those investments that I thought were going to be more resilient in a downturn. And because also most, the caveat to that is that most recessions are also relatively short term. I mean, I think the average recession is something like 11 months. And so, and you know, it could last 2 or 3 years, but typically they tend to be short lived. And so the main thing is just surviving that downturn and not getting wiped out. Right. And so by focusing on assets that are more resilient, I think it allows you to do that, to wait it out, and then to eventually, you know, benefit from the eventual recovery.
And I had personal experience with you when I called you on recently, beginning of this year, at some point on a retail development deal, which is in the north, you know, Dallas area where I live, and it's in a great location, and you know they already had some, you know, some people lined up that were great tenants. But you told me, Darren, be careful. You know, we're at the end of the economic cycle, and retail is an area that definitely will be impacted when it turns. Don't know when it's going to turn, but if it turns during that time, you know, you could have troubles. Now, I decided not to invest in that deal, thankfully. But that has come to fruition. I would say, correct me if I'm wrong, but retail and office seem to be the areas, and obviously anything
hospitality.
The most difficult areas right now. So being involved in multifamily seems to be, you know, we're still early in this process. We're a couple months in, but seems to be pretty resilient compared to these other asset classes.
For sure. And it also depends on the type of multifamily. And, you know, there are people that are doing multifamily developments, which I think are going to be similarly affected negatively by what's going on. But also, in my opinion, I think, you know, if you're investing in very, you know, high quality new developments, what we call Class A type multifamily properties, where the rents are some of the highest in the submarket, I think those are going to be more vulnerable as well,
right,
to any recession. And so,
I'm sorry, you said that you kind of prep yourself for these downturns. Now, you know, now that we're in one, how do you look at the landscape going forward? Do you look at, all right, I've got a lot of experience in multifamily and I want to continue to stay in that space and look for opportunities that, you know, come along in that space? Or do you look at, hey, you know, some of these other areas are going to be, you know, negatively impacted more, and, you know, there could be more upside in those types of real estate. So what's your take there?
Yeah. So, I think, first of all, we don't know. I mean, this is obviously a very unusual recession. It's not just a sort of a regular cyclical type of a recession. So there's no telling how long it'll last. I mean, I know that was one of your questions. I think personally that the amount of damage that's being done to the economy is going to be longer lasting. And I'm not one of those people that believe in a V-shaped recovery, that things, as soon as things get better and the public health crisis is averted, that all of a sudden we're just going to go back to where things were before. It could happen. I don't believe it. I think there's going to be businesses that are completely shut down and they're not going to come back. And the amount of unemployment that's going on right now with tens of millions of people and many, many businesses shutting down, I think that it's going to take a significant period of time to recover. I would, if I was to venture a guess, I would say probably 2 to 3 years.
Right. And so, I hear that from a lot of people that I talk to that are in multinational corporations, and they're, you know, just talking to the different divisions across the world, and they're saying similar, that there's no way that this is going to turn around in 6 months, or a year for that matter. This is going to be more like 2 or 3 years, and 30 million unemployed, you know, is just unfathomable that we're in that position. I think, you know, so I tend to lean in your direction as well on that side. I guess the biggest unknown is that, you know, the government has thrown unprecedented funds towards this. So far, $2 trillion. Now there's potentially another $2 or $3 trillion on the table.
Right.
You know, how will that impact and, you know, the economy coming back? You know, that's the question mark. And I don't think any of us know the answer to that.
Yeah. I mean, look, $2.2 trillion in terms of fiscal stimulus, but then everything that the Federal Reserve is doing, which is also several trillion dollars of monetary stimulus, and it's unprecedented. I mean, even compared to the government response in 2008, this is, you know, five times the size. It's incredible. And that is going to mitigate some of the blow, that the economy would otherwise take. And so it is a balancing act in terms of, you know, the economy sort of spiraling downwards, and then the government response at unprecedented levels in terms of fiscal policy and monetary policy. It's going to be a balancing act in terms of how it plays out. And I got a feeling that the stimulus is going to, I think there's a lot more to come, because I think there's going to be a lot more that's needed.
Right.
So I think I expect that there's going to be various phases. So the House apparently just passed another $3 trillion stimulus package, which we'll see what the Senate does. But I think there's going to be several future rounds of stimulus.
Right.
Which will help.
Absolutely. You know, one more topic before we get into multifamily, but what's your take on negative interest rates?
So yeah,
interest rates have been, they're a reality in other parts of the world. And there's a lot of debate, you know, domestically as to whether we should go down that path or not. What's your take on that? And how does that impact real estate?
Yeah. So let's just be clear on what we're talking about. So, you know, there's interest rates on the short end of the yield curve, which is essentially controlled, manipulated by the Federal Reserve, which is the Fed funds rate.
Right.
And, but if you're talking about...
Let's talk about the 10-year.
So if you're talking about the 10-year...
10-year going negative.
Yeah. So if you talk about the 10-year, that's more market-driven, right? So that's going to be based more on what the behavior of the market participants are, and if they're buying treasury bonds or selling treasury bonds. So I think, I believe that the 10-year is yielding about 60 basis points, 0.6%.
Correct.
And I do personally believe that that's going to go negative. Now, I don't think the Fed is going to take Fed funds negative. That I would be surprised. But I do think that the 10-year is probably going to go to negative yields, and which hasn't really happened in any sustainable fashion in the United States. But it's been happening for years in Japan and Europe. And so it's not unheard of at this point. And I think based on the depth of the current downturn, I can totally see the 10-year going negative. And, you know, look, I think the impact on multifamily is not necessarily going to be drastically different than now, because interest rates are super low right now as it is.
So you don't think cap rates will drop with that?
I don't think cap rates will drop right away. I mean, eventually low interest rates will stimulate the economy. And when the economy grows and, you know, starts to experience more and more growth, that's going to cause, cap rates to decline. So it's a complicated relationship between interest rates and cap rates. So if you look at, until recently, interest rates had been rising for a few years, but cap rates continued going down. And so it's a little bit of a misnomer to say that cap rates are right. correlated with interest rates completely.
Which normal, in most normal markets, that would not happen, but that did happen over the last couple of years, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So I think, you know, look, the way everything is supply and demand, cap rates ultimately are going to be determined based on supply and demand. And I think the marketplace is going to assess the current situation as being in a higher, you know, a higher risk environment. And I think buyers will be demanding higher cap rates in this higher risk environment. And so even though interest rates are basically zero again, I think cap rates are going to be trending upwards for the foreseeable future.
Okay. So what kind of the talk I hear through being on different, you know, national real estate conference calls and whatnot is that the Texas market, the Dallas market, may have a 5 to 10% hit, but there's probably not a bloodbath coming. Also hear from other avenues that, you know, where some of the opportunities may lie are with, people that have bridge loans that are coming due and they can't refinance or properties that they were under, 3 years interest only, and that interest only period is ending and they don't have the cash flow to sustain the principal payment. And that, because of the agency financing requirements of having 12 to 18 months principal and interest reserves that have just come into place since going into COVID, that most likely the opportunities are going to lie in deals that have assumptions, loan assumptions. Do you agree with those, kind of standard findings that people are kind of putting out into the marketplace right now?
Yeah, look, I think, so there's a lot of people chomping at the bit, like looking for opportunities, right? People in our world, right? Syndicators and even passive investors. And I would say a couple of things. One is it's too early. I think that the real opportunities happen when the amount of distress in the marketplace is relatively severe. And also, by the way, if everyone and their mother is looking for an opportunity, it's too early by definition. It's got to be scary. Like the best opportunities, if you look at 2008, 2009, the people that took advantage of those opportunities right. were going against the grain.
Right.
It was scary to do it at that time. And right now, I think it's too early is what I would say. And also, there's a big disconnect between sellers and buyers.
Yeah.
Right. Buyers are looking for the opportunity. Sellers haven't
right.
accepted the fact that they're going to have to sell their property for 10% or whatever percent less than they could have 3 months ago.
Right.
And so that'll shake out at some point.
Where so far, that scary period was probably what? Like a week or two when the stock market was just tanking, right?
Right.
And nobody knew what to believe about this, COVID virus, and everybody was just right. trying to understand. There was probably like a week or two in there, but what you're referring to is more of a look, people have invested and they get, and then a market tanks and people don't have the capital anymore to invest, right? Or they're just so fearful that it's just going to keep falling that they don't
That's
invest.
Right.
And that time
That's
it
right.
has not come, which is really bizarre when we're in the middle of the worst crisis that we've ever experienced so far.
It's so quick. And I mean, it happens so fast. And then the government stimulus and support has been equally fast.
Right.
So there's certainly distress, but it hasn't in the sense that people have lost their jobs. I think at the personal level and at the family level, there's been quite a bit of distress, but it hasn't trickled down into the property values yet and the marketplace yet.
Right.
It will. And it's very early on in the recession, and it just hasn't been that long. So I think there will be opportunities. And the opportunities that we look for today are very different than the opportunities we would have looked for pre-COVID. You know, in the past, we would look at a property that, let's say, had unrenovated units, right? And you
right.
know this. So, it might have been 90, 95% occupied, but they hadn't upgraded their units and their, you know, what we call classic units. And it was ripe for upgrading and renovating.
And you could prove the value because three properties down the road had already done the renovation. So you knew what kind of rent bump you could get.
Exactly. It's a phenomenal strategy. Very, very lucrative, very, very successful in the last 5, 6, 7 years. And the idea was you buy the property, you raise extra capital to do the renovations, and you do the renovations, you make it a nicer product, and you raise rents. And by raising rents, you're dramatically increasing the property value, and then you can refinance or sell and make a lot of money for your investors. That worked really, really well. But I would say that that strategy is a mid to late cycle strategy when we're talking about an economic boom. And that's not the type of opportunity that I would recommend looking for in today's environment, because we're not in an economic boom right now, where it's the opposite. We're in a downturn.
So what do you look for?
Yeah. So we're in the early stages of the next cycle. You don't want to underwrite a deal assuming you're going to be able to raise rents when there's 30 million people unemployed and incomes have gone down. So the deals are going to be harder to come by in some ways, but when you're underwriting them, you want to assume zero rent growth. I mean, just keeping rents flat and see if it still makes sense in terms of your underwriting. And what it means generally is that you're going to have to buy cheap enough that even without the upside of increasing rents, that it's still going to generate good returns for your investors. So I think it's more what we'd call a yield play rather than an appreciation play. I will say this, that the very low interest rates will help.
Right.
So, you know, you might not have the upside from appreciation the way you would have a year ago. But because you can get loans at 3.5-4% right now and long term with agency, you know, with Fannie or Freddie, and lock it in long term, and that's really going to help with the returns. But I think
the challenge is the reserves, though, right?
Yeah, for new debt, right? So I think there is definitely going to be opportunity, to your point, for people, owners that have loans that are coming due, and it's not just bridge loans. Even if it's agency loans that are coming due, and they either have to sell or refinance, and if their income, their collections have gone down at all, which they probably have. It's going to be hard to refinance for the same amount that they currently owe.
Right.
And so there's going to be a lot of opportunities in the near future where sellers are very motivated to sell because they can't refinance without doing a capital call, which most sponsors don't want to do. So they'll be forced to sell. And at that point, we're going to be in a situation that we haven't seen in many years, which is it's a buyer's market.
Right.
It's going to be a buyer's market, and you're going to have motivated sellers as opposed to the opposite, where you had motivated buyers and it was a seller's market for many,
many years. It sounds very similar. So, you know, I've been on the loan trading space for many, many years. And so investors that got involved with our deal that I knew personally that didn't really understand multifamily said, you know, asked me what the biggest risk was. And I had never been in a downturn owning real estate, right? Like this. But what I did see is the same exact thing happened on the loan side, where the loans went bad, where the loans that came due in a terrible economy. And so whether it be bridge loan or whatever, you know, none of these multifamily or commercial real estate loans have 30-year fixed rate mortgages. They all have some kind of balloon feature. And as the sponsor, you always want to be protecting that reset, that refinance time period doesn't come about in a terrible economy. And that's where most likely the opportunities are coming. So,
and I think you're right. I think you're going to see more and more deals done where the buyer basically just takes over the debt, assumes the loan.
Right.
And that's it.
Right.
And that's it. So, no equity on top of that.
And then the sponsor on this as the seller. So everybody gets wiped out, you know, their equity gets completely wiped out, but the sponsors that put the deal together at least save their credit by not, you know, having the loan go into default.
Yeah, look, that's a horrible situation to be in, but that's the situation that, I mean, that's really where we're talking about distressed situations, distressed properties, because if they don't sell, they're going to end up getting foreclosed on.
Right.
And then, you know, that's not going to help their investors out. Their investors are going to get wiped
out
anyway.
So
this is just a way. So I think it's going to go in that direction. And, you know, as a sponsor and anybody that's listening to this, that's a syndicator, I mean, I think that's going to be one of the categories of opportunities to look for, is where you can just kind of take over the debt. And whether it's, you know, nothing on top of that, or maybe just a small amount on top of the debt, that's going to help. The other thing I wanted to say is, when you're looking for mostly what I was referring to as yield plays, you know, you also, you know, you want to underwrite it. I wouldn't underwrite rent growth. And I would be very conservative with how you're underwriting, you know, what we call the reversion cap rate. You want to be conservative there. But, you know, I think you also want to stress test, right? You want to stress test and see, you know, how's the cash flow going to be if occupancy drops, or if you have to, not just to keep rents the same, what if you have to cut rents by 10%?
Right.
Just because people can't afford it anymore. Let's just say this, you know, economy still continues to go downward. You may have to cut rents just so people can afford it. And so you don't want to be in a situation where as soon as you do that, all of a sudden your cash flow is negative. And the other thing that's really critical is cash reserves right now. Is really, if you're going to do a deal, you want to have a lot of cash reserves, because there's a certain unpredictability to how bad things are going to get. And again, you want to, you know, prevent default at all costs. So cash reserves right now, even, you know, raising more than you even think that you might need,
right,
I would say is really important right now.
Those are all fantastic points. And I'm glad that we went down that path. Let's transition to a deal you did earlier this year. I want to say it was $40 million plus.
Well, yeah, $42.5 million.
$42.5 million. That's incredible. So I don't know if you remember this or not. So we were at a one of the marketing, you know, get it together events, and we were all day. And then at the end of the day, we went to this restaurant called Eureka, and, you know, in the uptown Dallas market. And so me, you, Anna, and a few other people sat down and had dinner. And you were pretty new to the group. You know, not extremely new, but pretty new. It was, you know, and we were talking about a large deal that got done, and it was within the group, and it was a two property deal, and it was like $30 or $35 million deal. And I don't know if you remember this, but you said, "I'm going to beat that record." And then Brad Sumrock walked by, and you stopped him at our table, and you said, "Brad, how big was that deal that just got done?" And he told you it was 30 something, and you said, "I'm going to beat that one." And I don't know if you remember that, but here we are.
I remember.
$42.5 million, and right now you and Anna have the record in the group. So help our listeners understand how you got the deal, what you liked about the deal, and you know, what the capital raise was and how long it took to raise the money.
Yeah. So I remember that dinner actually very well. I think that was the first time you and I met, and
that was hilarious. I love that you did it. You know, there's not too many people that are going to be ballsy enough to go up and say that, but then you know what, you took action and you made it happen. That's awesome.
Yeah. I think that was probably summer of 2018. So I had only been part of the group for maybe 3 months or something like that.
Right.
And that was before you and I did our deal together. So, I think, so that deal was, 420 units. We called it the Wimberley portfolio, and it was a combination of two properties that were side by side and, same seller. And, the seller had owned these properties since 1992 during the whole RTC thing. And he literally had owned it for, you know, what is that, 28 years, and hadn't hardly done any upgrades to it. So again, this is pre-COVID, right? So we looked at that as a phenomenal and very unusual opportunity that there were really no upgrades done. These units were more or less in their original classic condition. And, you know, the properties were well maintained and they were very highly occupied, you know, 96, 97, 98%. But the rents were low, below market, when I by low, meaning even below market, and they hadn't been upgraded at all. And so we looked at this opportunity. It's pretty rare because most properties have traded two or three times in the last 10 years.
Right.
And every time there's a new buyer, they're doing some level of upgrade and renovation. And then the next buyer, they leave some meat on the bone for the next buyer. And this one, these hadn't traded in 29 years or 28 years. And so it was just ripe. 100% of the units hadn't been upgraded. And so when we underwrite just modest rent increases from upgrading the property, it just underwrote really, really well. So it was super exciting. It was a listed deal. And, you know, in terms of how we won the deal, I mean, I'd say, you know, better than anyone. I've heard you talk about it a lot. You know, it's a relationship business. And we were actually the third highest bidder on this two property portfolio. And we won the deal.
Awesome.
And we won the deal for a couple different reasons. And this is, you know, for the listeners, yeah. I think, always remember that, you know, it is a relationship business more than anything. And so I'd say we won the business for two main reasons. One is the brokers knew us, me and Anna, and had already closed deals with us. So they knew that we were for real, that we weren't just, you know, tire kickers, and that we knew what we were doing, and that we had the ability to raise the capital. It was obviously a very large deal, and it was our largest deal, and we had to raise about $13 million, and which is a lot of money. But the brokers had confidence in us that we were going to close, that we weren't going to play games, and that we would have the ability to raise the capital. That was one part of it. And they had a relationship with us, and the brokers also, you know, we were fortunate. They didn't really have a strong relationship with the two other buyers that had actually offered more than we did.
Fantastic.
That's one aspect of it. The other aspect was just, we were very lucky. It was, the seller had a close relationship with the property management group. So the property management, company that had been managing these properties for the last 7 or 8 years, you know, they had done a great job, but I also had a very close relationship, have a very close relationship with this same property management company.
You do, and from another property?
From prior, several properties. And I've known them since 2013. In fact, you know, my first property, the one that I mentioned that I sold before joining this group to a couple of Sumrock sponsors, that property was managed by the same property management group. And so what happened is, and I didn't know this at the time, but the seller was very close friends with the president of that property management company. And when the president of the property management company, this gentleman named Bruce, when he found out that I was bidding and I was up in the running,
right,
you know, in the top three, he reached out to his friend and client, the seller, and vouched for me, vouched for us.
That's huge, huge.
And the seller ended up actually calling me, which is very unusual, by the way, to speak directly with the seller. But because of this unique situation, he actually ended up calling me. And he even told me, he's like, look, Bruce vouched for you. I wanna sell the deal to you. And I mean, I've never heard those words before on another transaction. So that was pretty crazy. And so, you know, I think the other buyers, other offers that came in were $500,000 to $1 million more than ours.
Wow.
And true to his word, he accepted ours. And it was kind of, you know, we kind of triangulated a little bit. We had the brokers vouching for us, and we had the property management company and the seller's friend vouching for us. And that combination worked in our favor.
That's fantastic. So I have a lot of sidebar conversations with people that are looking to get into the space or have or are in the space, but they're trying to get their first deal. And I try to paint the picture that, you know, all these deals are so competitive and, you know, who knows if that'll change going forward or not, but you know, it's not just in Dallas. Dallas is extremely competitive, but I hear it from syndicators all across the country. It's a similar process. You know, you have 15 offers, you know, five or six go into best and final. And then I paint the picture that there's, you know, there's typically like three offers that are, you know, relatively close. And then the seller and the broker sit down together and the seller says, who should I go with? And in your case, one, the fact that you had already done deals with the broker and they knew you, you know, so they could vouch for you. But then in addition to that, that the management company knew you, liked you, and vouched for you to the seller. So those were two things that pushed you over the edge, you know? So that's where I talk to people and I say, you always have to think about that conversation when you're starting to go after a deal, because assume that you're going to be one of those three. And why should they pick you? And, you know, I have some people that they're new and they just, and I tell them, you can't win a deal unless you partner with somebody who has experience, because there's too many other buying groups that have experience. So when you get to that discussion point and you're one of the three, there's a high probability that one of the other two are going to have successfully closed transactions. And the broker, it's going to be less risky for him or her to recommend that buying group. So it's critical to partner with somebody that has experience. Now, you and Anna had the experience. That was no issue. But, you know, a property that's $42.5 million, it's your largest property. And it also brings in potentially institutional buyers because it's a larger deal. You know, I'm sure that there were qualified buyers in that offering group. But the relationships pushed it over the edge, which that's awesome. And I didn't even know that piece of it. So thank you for sharing that.
I will say that just on that property that we closed in January. And so it was pre-COVID. And, you know, I mentioned that when we underwrote it and we underwrote all these renovations and upgrades and raising rents and all that, and it was phenomenal. But we were also very mindful that we were very late cycle. And there were already, you know, the yield curve had inverted and there was already like signs, leading indicators that maybe the recession wasn't going to be that far down the line. Certainly didn't know about COVID, but, you know, just a regular economic downturn. And so we really prepared for that by raising quite a bit extra in reserves, just to have cash reserves with no particular purpose. And so, I mean, we're in the situation now where we have several million dollars just in cash, and we're not going to be doing all the upgrades and renovations right now because this isn't the economic environment to do that. You don't want to be raising rents in this environment. We'll eventually do it when the economy is better. But that might be, you know, 2 years from now. It might be a year from now. It might be 2 years from now, 3 years from now. But in the meantime, we have all this cash and we have the safety net that's going to keep us out of trouble. And, you know, obviously we got new debt before all these new reserve requirements. And we got a 3.99% rate locked in for 12 years.
Unbelievable.
And so, but I would say, you know, I just wanted to point out that we raised a lot of extra cash, more than normal, just because of where we were in the economic cycle. And we didn't know COVID was going to happen, but that's the way it is. You don't know what's going to happen.
No, that was very smart. And it comes from, you know, your risk profile, where you're a student of economic cycles. You knew where you were and you just wanted to have some extra cushion. And so talk about, this is exciting part, you know, talk about how long it took to raise, what did you say, 12 and a half million?
13 million, over 13 million.
13 million. So it must have been a long, drawn out process to raise 13 million. Help us understand.
Yeah. So, I mean, by far the most that we ever tried to raise for one deal.
Right.
And we also, to be honest, were a little nervous because the money had to be raised during the holidays. I mean, we closed in January, but we had to start marketing the deal around Thanksgiving and then, you know, Christmas holidays. And we're like, well, people are going to be tuned out,
right?
You know, and, you know, are they really going to be even looking at our emails and even thinking about investments? And here we are going after our largest raise ever during, you know, this very busy time of the year for most people. And so we planned, you know, maybe it would take 4, 5, 6 weeks. I mean, it's a lot of money. And we planned, we were a little nervous about it. We tried to have some extensions built into the contract just in case. And honestly, it was, we were shocked, but it, within 2 or 3 days, we had been fully subscribed in terms of soft commitments. And obviously, you know, it takes a while for all the money to be wired in and all that, but that, we were fully subscribed.
That's amazing.
And we started putting people on wait lists, like literally within a few days.
Amazing.
And completely unexpected. Yeah.
But you know that, yeah. You know, talk about relationships that, you know, your reputation on other deals, right? And how you dealt with investors and how you have that fiduciary responsibility to, you know, preserve capital and all those discussions that you've had with investors that led up to that, you and Anna, and you two powerhouses, you know, combined, and that was the outcome. But that's an amazing feat to raise that much money in that, you know, in just 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, we were, and we had some other partners as well that helped, and you know, we were very pleased. And I think it's a combination of a lot of things, but I think the deal itself was very attractive. It was very unique, and that was part of it. And then I think it's really the relationships that we've built up, to your point, over the years, really made a difference. And you know, we may do a few deals a year, and I think there's a pent-up demand, which we didn't realize, but there was a pent-up demand where people were just kind of, you know, hoping that we would have a deal that they could invest in. And we were very, very pleased. And I'll tell you, it's encouraging, right? Because it tells us that we can, you know, that was the largest deal that we had done up to this point. And it told us that we could play in that space.
That's amazing.
We could excel in that space. So,
all right. So let's transition a little bit. I don't know. It's happened to me. Okay, in various stages, various different decision points, but I don't know where it's occurred for Raj. Talk to me about fear, and you know, when were you fearful, and how did you overcome that? And that could be, you know, making a decision to transfer from one industry to another. It could be, you know, just going into a bigger deal. It could be a lot of different things, but we all different, you know, all of us have to battle fear in one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think for me, again, going back to being sort of obsessed with risk, I mean, even from a personal level, you know, that's the case. It's not about not taking risk. I mean, sometimes it's the right decision to make, but certainly, you know, feeling it and being thoughtful about it is important. I'd say, you know, I'd answer that question in a few different ways. I remember when I first started in investing in real estate back in, really I started in 2007 and 2008. And even though I knew investments pretty well from my background, I didn't know real estate that well. And I remember going to different boot camps and, you know, trying to read books and just networking and going to the local, you know, REI like meetings, RIA meetings,
right.
And things like that. Right. And just trying to be a sponge. And which, by the way, I'd recommend to everyone that's getting started.
Absolutely.
You know, just read as much as you can. Go to as many meetings as you can. Ask. And now it's a lot easier because of social media. I mean, there's Facebook groups. But back then, you know, there wasn't as much, but there was still quite a bit out there. And I realized that I was never going to, I mean, this was one of the insights that I had. I'm never going to get to the point where I just feel like, you know what? I'm ready. I'm totally comfortable.
Right.
I'm ready. I've learned everything that I need to learn and I'm ready.
Exactly.
Right. And you never get there because I think it's intuitively you think, okay, if I get smart enough and if I read enough and learn enough, I'm going to get to the point where I'll know enough and I'll feel comfortable investing. And my feeling is that you never get there.
Right.
You never get there.
How many books have you read that talk about business owners that they have to make decisions with, you know, incomplete information?
That's right.
You know, and that's, you know, but some people aren't able to make those decisions. You know, some people right. aren't able to do that. But that's a critical component as you allude to.
Yeah. And so the way I got started is I got a couple buddies, you know, that were good friends of mine, and none of us had experience with real estate. And we just decided, let's just do it. We're going to team up. And we didn't have a lot of money by the way, back then. And this was pre-Great Recession. So there was some still interesting, you know, creative financing structures and stuff that you could employ that really aren't available anymore. But, you know, we did what we could. We hustled and we bought, I remember, within 24 hours, it was February 27th of 2008. We bought a single family home in Chicago in a really bad neighborhood. We bought two single family homes down on the Mississippi coast. And we bought a 16-unit apartment complex as a foreclosure in like one of the worst parts of Detroit. Okay. So, you know, not necessarily
baby steps, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it all happened. We ended up closing. And honestly, like we learned so much, especially me. I learned so much just from buying those properties and then managing them, like finding property management companies and dealing with evictions and renovating units and trying to raise rents and just dealing with all of that. And I mean, I wouldn't be where I am today if I hadn't bought that really, you know, crappy 16-unit
right.
apartment complex in the worst part of Detroit. And I actually just sold it last year. I had it all these years. But, you know, and sometimes I get asked, if I'm on a panel or something, I'll get asked about, you know, how someone should get started. And sometimes I'll just say, just get your first deal done.
Right.
I mean, I always say educate yourself, right? Like, yeah, join a program but read as much as you can. Go to real estate focused networking events. Definitely try to educate, you know, get coaching or whatever, join a mentor group, but also like just dive in and do your first deal one way or another. Maybe that means partnering with people. And if you don't have capital, maybe you can do something else and partner with somebody that does have access to capital.
What I heard you say was, you know, you got educated, you read a lot of books, you went to a lot of meetings, but at some point there was a trigger. At some point you said to yourself, I just got to do it, you know,
and just do it.
And so you and your buddies agreed, we don't know it all, but we're just going to do it. And I think that that is a critical, critical moment in somebody's life to be able to make that decision, because otherwise there's always another book you can read. There's always That's right. another podcast you can listen to. There's always another person that you can meet. But at some point for yourself as a listener, you have to say to yourself, I'm going to do this, whatever goal you're trying to achieve.
That's right. And 100%. And you know what it is it's an insecurity that you feel.
Correct.
Which by the way is very normal. And you know, it's very normal to feel when you're doing something new like that and you don't feel like you know enough or have enough experience. It can in real estate, it can be overwhelming. You think about, oh, I don't know all the legalities and the contracts and I don't know what I don't know, you know, and it can be a very powerful feeling. And then people end up just trying to continue educating themselves. And at some point, I mean, it's important to educate yourself, but at some point it becomes a crutch. And at some point you're going to plateau on what you're learning. And then it has to, from a theoretical learning, and then it has to become experiential learning.
Right.
And the experiential learning is where the rubber really hits the road and where you really learn. And so I would say, you know, get to your first deal one way or another, the best way you can. And if that means partnering, then partner. but I would say at some point, just bite the bullet and dive in.
Right. And some people have asked me, well, how do you fight past the fear? And it sounds like my answer is similar to yours probably, is that, look, I went back in my own mind and thought about different scary decisions I made and then what the outcomes were. You know, so I started out as a CPA with Pricewaterhouse, and then at some point I decided I want to get into sales. Well, that everybody told me I was crazy, right? But then when I did that, all of a sudden my income shot up dramatically, right? You know, for you, you had to make a decision to get out of wealth management and to go into real estate. And that was a scary decision, but you did that because you also saw your decision to go into the Navy and how that was a positive decision, and how going from the Navy into wealth management was a positive decision. And so you can rely on some of those past experiences in your head to push you, you know, just to get a nudge you over that ledge.
For sure. For sure. And I think these are major life decisions like that require a lot of thought. And, but there is something to be said for having the confidence that it's going to work out and that you're going to, you know, you're going to do okay and you're going to survive, and based on experience and based on relationships and things like that. But I would say, you know, leaving active duty in 2004, because I loved the Navy and I loved the JAG Corps and I loved everything about it. And that was a very hard decision. And at that point, it was just a personal decision. My wife and I wanted to start a family and start having kids. And, you know, the Navy lifestyle is just to keep moving every few years. And, you know, we also, her parents and my parents, our families are here in the Chicago area. And we were halfway across the world for, you know, 4 years. And we just decided that it was time to, you know, time to come home and settle down and start a family. But what I did is, because I love the Navy so much, I love wearing the uniform so much, I decided to stay and affiliate with the reserves. And that was my way of not completely walking away from the Navy. And so stayed in the reserves from 2004 till now.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So what's next for Raj? I mean, you just do a $42.5 million deal, you know, 2 years ago. We're having dinner and you say that, you kind of set that big goal. You know, all the books that I've read say once you hit that goal, you got to set the next one. So what's the next big one for Raj? What's coming down the pike?
You know, I think we want to, you know, keep doing what we're doing and keep doing it better. And I think it's not just about doing bigger and bigger deals. That's not necessarily going to continue happening. I mean, there's a limit to, you know, how, you know, moving on to a 50, 60, 70, 80 million.
Right. It doesn't always have to be bigger. Right. But right. What I've heard from you and what I know of you, because I know you pretty well, is, you know, Raj can go after a challenge. Right. So just doing what I'm doing, I don't know. I guess I'm pushing on you a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
What else is out
there
for you?
Well, I think that's fair enough. I think, you know, certainly keep doing what we're doing, keep going after deals. I think what's going on with COVID changes the landscape completely. And I want to stay at the forefront as a thought leader in the space. And
all right, I'm jumping in again.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Raj, when are you going to write a book?
Ah, there you go. So, you know, I'll say that, and you know this because we've talked about it a lot. Coming back to, you know, being a student of the economy and making a lot of investment decisions and things like that, I just feel like, you know, I have a lot to share and things that I've learned. And my background's a little bit different than a lot of people that do real estate syndication. And wasn't necessarily ready to talk about this, but it's, you know, it's something that I've been thinking about for a few years.
Well, sometimes you got to just say it, right?
Yeah. Before,
you know,
yeah,
to put yourself on the hook and put yourself accountable.
I think it is a goal of mine.
So 2020,
probably do that.
2020, you're going to write a book?
maybe start the process towards the end of the year, I think. But I will say this, and you know, I appreciate you inviting me to your podcast. But one of the things that I am going to do is make more of an effort getting out there. Writing a book is part of it, but just being out there, sharing ideas, being a thought leader, and you know, sharing more of my views on different podcasts, and just trying to be as helpful as I can. And again, I think I have a little bit of a unique background, and
I think you have a wealth of knowledge, and that's why, you know, we spent so much time together here today, because you know, there's just so much to pull out of Raj, and there's just so much that, you know, can be shared. And that goes back to your service, you know, in the forces, and your service mentality of what, you know, when you thought of success, it wasn't all about the money. It was about, you know, also giving back. And I know writing a book is a challenge, right? Especially writing your first book. But buying your first 100 unit deal is a challenge, right? And you accomplished that. And so we talked a while ago about the book, and I think that you should write a book, because there's so many people that you can help. Okay. You could be on podcasts, but they may not see the podcast. They may not listen, but putting yourself out there with a book, and it's also a legacy thing. It's a legacy thing for your family, you know, your kids, to see. And if you didn't have a lot to share with the world, I wouldn't push you on this, but you know, I appreciate you as a person. I appreciate you as a business partner, and I think you have a lot to offer. So, I would love it if you would commit to doing it on the show right now to the audience, and then we see it come to fruition. Because I know if you say it, it will happen. But you've given yourself a little bit of an out so far.
Yeah, fair enough. I think, first of all, Darren, I mean, you know, you're a great friend, and I appreciate your support. And no, you're right, and you know me personally, and you know that this is something that I've felt compelled to do for a while. And it's just like you say, it's a matter of making a decision and focusing on it. So, okay, I will commit to you
all
as
right.
a friend and to
yes.
our listeners.
When
that I will, I think. I will start the process towards the end of this year.
So will it come out in 2021?
Probably 21. Yeah.
2021.
Yep.
All right. Awesome. Awesome. I look forward to it, my friend. I look forward to it. I look forward to having you back on the show and telling everybody, check out this book. Fantastic. So two more things and then we're done. So passive investments. Have you invested passively into other people's deals? And, you know, what's your advice to people that are listening that haven't done any real estate investments? They've heard of the idea of passively investing in a larger deal, but they don't know how to do it. You know, how do they find out about deals? And, you know, how do they find out about people that are putting deals together, and how, you know, what's involved, and how can they get involved?
Yeah, I mean, I think a good question. It's like a lot of things in life. I mean, if you want to get into something, you just got to dive in. And my advice would be to educate yourself, but go to different groups that specialize in this stuff, and then you'll meet people that are sponsoring deals, and you exchange cards. At least in the old days, you exchanged cards,
right?
And what happens is, you know, when I meet somebody and they are interested in investing, you know, I'll add them to my list. And, you know, when there is something to raise money for, you know, and if I have a relationship with this person, I can inform them of the deal. And they don't have to invest. But what I would say is I've given this advice out before to others that are looking to get into investing is, you know, listen to as many, like look at as many deals as you can, listen right. to as many webinars as you can. And you don't have to invest in every one, but you know what you're going to see is you're going to see a lot of different sponsors that have different approaches, that have different backgrounds, that have a different business strategy. You're going to look at assets and deals, different geographic locations. And you're going to see how they answer questions on the webinar. You're going to see, you know, what kind of underwriting assumptions they made and what kind of growth assumptions they made. And you know what? And even if you don't invest, you're going to learn. And you're going to learn about how sponsors are different from each other and how deals are different from each other. And you're going to get a better sense on what kind of things you like and you're more comfortable with, or get you more excited, and what other kinds of things you don't like. And so I think I would highly recommend that. Just meet as many sponsors, like syndicators, as you can that are putting these deals together. And the way to do that is join different Facebook groups, listen to these different podcasts like yours, because you're going to have a lot of guests on that are probably in the business of putting deals together and syndicating, and your listeners are going to have the ability to reach out to these guests and hopefully get on their distribution list and find out about what kinds of deals that they're doing. But I think that
also going to meetup groups, there's different meetup groups in everybody's local city. You know, if you haven't downloaded the app Meetup, you should. It's Meetup, and then just put in multifamily investing or apartment investing and find some meetup groups in your area. And then, as Raj mentioned, when you go to that group, it's going to be a mix of some people that are syndicators and some people that are just passive investors. You want to talk to both of them. So you want to talk to the syndicators and exchange cards, like Raj said, so that next time they send out an email on their deal, you get to see it and you get on their, watch their webinar. And you also want to talk to other passive investors and say, who have you invested with? You know, where have you had success? And who do you like, you know, doing business with? So those are all great ways to get out there and learn how to get your first passive deal. So with that, Raj, I know that you and Anna just, you know, you've partnered up on, you've said five deals. I thought it was three, but
five properties. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. And you now have just come out with a new website and a new company name. Where can listeners reach out to you if they want to reach out to you?
Yeah. So, appreciate that. Just a few days ago, Anna and I launched our new company and new brand, and it's called Impact Prosperity Partners. And the website is www.impactprosperity.com. And, very excited, like you were asking me about, like, what's next for us. This was kind of a big step for us, because up till now, you know, we've done well in the sense that we've done deals and syndicated and all that, but to really just try to take it to the next level, creating a website and trying to put some good content on there. It's all very exciting. And so it's impactprosperity.com. I can be reached at Raj, that's R-A-J, at impactprosperity.com. And there's also, for anybody that goes to the site, on the homepage, there's you can opt into a newsletter. It's a free newsletter that we're going to be sending out to people. And so we'd love it if you can put your information there, and happy to take emails as well if anybody wants to reach out and talk to me directly.
That's awesome. Well, I've invested in passively into one of yours and Anna's deals. And I've also partnered with you as a general partner together. I highly recommend Raj. I'm incredibly honored to have you on as the first guest of the podcast. And I'm sure that, when you get your book completed, we will have you back on the show. But thank you for being on the show. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed that one. Please, let us know what we can do going forward. If there's certain guests that you want us to have on the show, certain topics you want discussed, let us know. Until next time, signing off.
All right, Darren, thank you so much.
Thanks, Raj. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show at darrenbatchelder.com. If you liked the episode, please provide us with a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. If you already provided us with a 5-star review, then thank you, and please share the show with a friend.